So, in the last talk, we looked at the bodhicitta. We contemplated just a little bit that suprapersonal force that leads to the liberation of all beings. And now we need to turn to how we can open up to such a force, how we can practice to open up to that, how we might turn ourselves into a receptacle for such a force, an egoless force. How our practice within the movement, within the order, might open us up to that. And at the end of yesterday's talk, I mentioned three areas. Individual Dharma practice, firstly. Secondly, intensive practice of spiritual community. And thirdly, working with others to spread the Dharma. And today I want to look at the first of those, the area of individual Dharma practice. But first, a cautionary word came up in our study yesterday. I've said that we're engaging with these things to open up to attract, to give rise to, whatever language you prefer, the suprapersonal, the transpersonal force called the bodhicitta. But, and this is a big but, we need to give ourselves to our practices, to these areas of practice, without expectations. We need to plunge into them without thinking of reward or outcome. I've often been moved and also intrigued by that really lovely line in Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, which goes, "Just as a blind man might find by chance the priceless jewel in a heap of rubbish, somehow this bodhicitta has arisen in me." And there is, of course, here a sense of wonder, of amazement, that something so wonderful, so precious, so valuable, so sublime, the rising up of the force of wisdom and compassion, could possibly happen in such unpromising material. It says, by chance, don't take that chance too literally, that's more like, well, just what it feels like. Well, this is just extraordinary, this is just incredible. And I've wondered if Shantideva was someone who was so intent on his Dharma life, so fully engaged in it, so committed to it, and that made him so aware of his own failings that he just forgot all about attainment and achievement and all that sort of thing. And then one day, lo and behold, there's this new quality, this new energy, if you like, this bodhicitta, it's there. And there's just surprise, wonder, amazement. I wonder if that's what's going on with this verse. That's what it's expressing. We just need to give ourselves to our Dharma life in all its fullness and let the forces of the Dharma do their work. So let's look at the area then of individual Dharma practice. Well, first of all, of course, there needs to be a definite commitment to a clear and definite path of practice. The classic Dharma practice of ethical practice, meditation practice, wisdom practice through study and reflection and so on. So the three trainings, those are the broad, that's the broad kind of training we engage in. And in our own order, Bhante has sort of expanded that a bit by giving us a path of Dharma practice of five stages. We have mindfulness and integration. Secondly, positive, skillful emotion. Thirdly, spiritual death. Fourthly, spiritual rebirth. And fifthly, spiritual receptivity, although this also can mean spontaneous, compassionate activity. And there's quite a lot of material coming out about this right now. Quite a lot of order members are exploring this material in different ways and showing how the different meditation practices relate to these stages. Bhante has also said that in our different meditation practices we can go through all of those stages so that we can, in each of the meditation practices we have, we can actually traverse the different stages that are mentioned. So what I want to do in this talk is to look at the whole area of metta, of the development of metta altruism and see how all of the stages of the path can be traversed through a very thorough, deep, intensive engagement with metta-bhavana. And I'll be focusing particularly on mindfulness, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. So we're used to hearing about mindfulness as a path to wisdom, but we don't often consider metta in this way, and personally I think we need to. If we're serious about breaking down the barriers between self and other, if we really do see that as the way to enlightenment, then surely metta-bhavana is a key Dharma practice. And certainly, traditionally, it's a key to the arising of the bodhicitta. In early Mahayana tradition, well, even later Mahayana tradition, it's sometimes said that the Brahma-viharas of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity are altogether the bodhicitta. And it's recommended in all sorts of stages and systems of practice that we do dwell in those Brahma Viharas before we go any further. But let's look at, first of all, mindfulness and integration. How can we practice metta as mindfulness? How can we practice metta as a mindfulness practice? And how does metta lead to integration? Just a few areas to open up here. Often when mindfulness is discussed, people will usually concentrate the discussion on mindfulness of the body and its movements, or mindfulness of bodily sensations or mental states. That's where the discussion usually centres. But this is a very narrow view of mindfulness, actually. A very narrow view of mindfulness. Those things are important, of course, but mindfulness refers to a very broad, rich and deep field of experience. In fact, the whole of life, that's the scope and range of mindfulness, the whole of life and all of the life around us. And in various places throughout the tradition, we find references to mindfulness of others as a practice. And those references can easily be overlooked, so much so that Turbanti, in very early on in his expositions of the Dharma, in his expositions of mindfulness, gives a very strong place to mindfulness of others. This is in his teaching, especially of the four dimensions of awareness, which he discusses in the Eightfold Path series under Perfect Mindfulness. He doesn't use the traditional Satipatthana exposition there, I think for good reason. He talks about in mindfulness of environment, mindfulness of things, the things around us, nature, and so on. He talks about mindfulness of self, yes, the body and its movements, thoughts, feelings, emotions, and he gives a big place to mindfulness of others. He gives it a separate place. There is such a thing as mindfulness and awareness of others. And fourthly, there's mindfulness of reality, which isn't simply reflection on the lakshanas. It could also be recollecting the Buddha, recitation of a mantra. It's a very, very rich teaching, which I know some order members have done retreats on very successfully. And his discussion of mindfulness and awareness of others has the very strong statement that love, real love, metta, is awareness of the being of another. Awareness of the being of another. Seeing them fully as they are in themselves, stripped of all your views about them, what you want from them and so on. Love for others is awareness of the being of another. And in the oldest tradition, in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the sutta of which is about the development of loving kindness, which is in the Suttanipata of the Pali Canon, we find the Buddha saying towards the end of that sutta these two verses: "Let his heart of boundless love pervade the whole world. above, below and across, without any obstruction. Whether he stands, walks, sits, or lies down, always awake, he should develop this mindfulness of loving kindness. This, they say, is the divine abiding, the Brahma-vihara of loving kindness. So whether he stands, walks, sits, or lies down, always awake, he should wield this mindfulness of loving kindness. This, they say, is the divine abiding. So the expression of a heart of boundless metta is in constant mindfulness of developing metta in all our actions, in everything we do, walking, sitting, lying down, whatever it is. The word translated as mindfulness here is sati, which literally means, of course, memory or recollection. So mindfulness very often is about remembering what we're supposed to be doing, recollecting our purpose, recollecting our aspiration, recollecting our goal. And in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the goal is the welfare, the happiness, the well-being, the deep happiness of all beings, which is equivalent to our own goal of enlightenment. And we could perhaps try, as a kind of experiment on this retreat, making our mindfulness practice a continuous awareness of developing well-being for others in all that we do, in all of our actions, making that a constant recollection and remembrance, just constantly dwelling on developing loving kindness for others in everything we do, whether we're walking, sitting, lying down, eating our meal, washing up, going for a walk, doing our cleaning duty, whatever it is. If we did that, we would probably find a very rich field of Dharma practice opening up for us. Probably find that as well, that our mindfulness practice in all areas would improve dramatically. Because if you're really concentrating on developing mindfulness of loving kindness for others, you are going to have to be mindful in other areas. Shantideva in the Bodhicharyavatara has a chapter on mindfulness, and it's called Samprajanya Rakshana, the guarding of mindfulness and purpose. And he sort of yokes the practice of mindfulness to the development of the bodhicitta. He says this: those who have not developed the bodhicitta, which is hidden and contains the whole sum of the Buddha's teachings, wander the world in vain, trying to attain happiness and destroy suffering. Therefore, I should guard my mind well. If I let go of the vow to guard my mind, what will become of my other vows? So the aim is the arising of the bodhicitta, which contains the sum of all of the Buddha's teachings. That leads to happiness. That's the purpose. So I need to guard my mind to follow that purpose. So if we want to develop, if we want to give rise to, if we want to open up to this mind of wisdom and compassion, we need to guard our minds. We need to keep recollecting our purpose in all that we do. Especially we need to be mindful of the effect that we have on others and on our world. And it does include our environment as well, the things around us. Shantideva says, one should not throw down stools and other furniture violently with a crash. Nor should one pound on doors. One should always delight in silence. The crane, the cat, or the thief achieves his intended goal by moving quietly and gently. The spiritual aspirant should move in such a way at all times. So in these verses, there's this wonderful sense of not sort of creating waves and ripples on the environment. It's down to simple things like when we're at the table eating our meal. Well, there's a way in which we can move our chairs so that they scrape the floor, thus making a racket. Or we can move really quietly, not to disturb people and not to sort of damage our environment as well. Same thing in the shrine room. We can leave the shrine room or come into the shrine room either very, very silently, not disturbing those people meditating, or we can make a racket and disturb everybody. So, you know, these mindful practices, you can see if we practice them how they don't impact, how we'll reduce our impact, our negative impact on the world around us. So let's practice this on retreat. So, mindful of turning lights off, closing doors, yes, not scraping chairs, care with things. Padmaloka gets a real pounding. It has so much use by the community members and people coming on retreat. So we need to really take extra care for it. We need to tend it, including the grounds, of course, everything here. Because this is a special place that supports our Dharma practice. Buddhist literature actually has a very, very strong emphasis on what we'd call now environmental awareness or ecological awareness. I mean, traditionally, Buddhist monks, the mindfulness injunctions that are given to them, in modern terms, you would say that they'd have a very, very low footprint in terms of the effect on their environment. I mean, there's even sort of rules about where they urinate so they don't sort of damage plants and things like that. Very interesting in the way they dispose of food and that sort of thing. So this very, very simple life, a life stripped down, you can see it's actually having a very positive effect on the environment. Because, you know, for Buddhists, traditionally, everything is alive. And we need to be sensitive to that. Everything is alive. And places like Padmaloka, perhaps, are especially important because it's a place, an environment that is dedicated to supporting spiritual practice. But we need to bring this into everything we do. And this brings up the whole area as well of things like vegetarianism, and even veganism, if possible. And in the early days of the movement, we never needed to mention these things, but we need to mention them now because some Buddhists, you know, sort of reject the idea of being vegetarian or vegan or something like that. They wonder if it's really got anything to do with spiritual practice. But as an order, we are a vegetarian order, and quite a few order members are vegan as well because it is an expression of non-harm. We need to live a life where we're constantly trying to minimise the harm on our world and on our environment. These are expressions of mindfulness of others. And they also enable us to develop a sensitivity to the life around us. I mean, and it really is quite astonishing these days, hearing some of the rationalisations that people are coming out with for eating meat and so on. But the fact is, if you eat meat, you're contributing harm on your environment. It's a serious issue that needs to be engaged with if we're serious about the path of loving kindness in the Bodhisattva path. And Shantideva especially evokes how we can practice mindfulness of other people. He says this, there's a lovely passage. One should always have a smiling face. One should give up frowning and grimacing. Be the first to speak, a friend to everybody. One should respectfully receive the advice of those who are able to direct others, who offer unsolicited aid. One should be the pupil of everyone all the time. One should express one's appreciation of all that is well said. When one sees someone doing something good, one should encourage them with praises. One should speak of others' qualities in their absence and repeat them with pleasure. And when one's own praise is spoken, one should reflect on that person's recognition of virtue. One should speak confident, measured words, clear in meaning, delighting the mind, pleasing to the ear, soft and slow, and stemming from love. One should always look at people directly, as if drinking them in with the eye, thinking, depending on them alone, I will attain Buddhahood. One should be able and energetic, at all times acting on one's own initiative. In all actions, one should not leave any work to another. I think these are really beautiful verses. I think, and they give a very clear, I think, and down-to-earth and very attractive picture of how an aspiring bodhisattva is in relation to other people. And these are all expressions of mindfulness. They all come from this section on mindfulness in the Bodhicharyavatara. Shantideva is really drawing it out beautifully, that mindfulness is expressed in friendliness, being the first to speak, which I take to mean putting others at their ease, greeting them, helping them, and also being open to them, really willing to learn from everybody, from whoever you meet, making it clear that they have a contribution to make to your life. Noticing the good in others and rejoicing in that, but not getting sort of puffed up when you yourself are praised. Speaking well to others, confidently, and slowly, softly. What comes to mind when I read that is Manjugosha, the sweet voiced, the soft voiced, and Shantideva was incredibly devoted to Manjugosha. Manjugosha was his sort of patron deity, so to speak, his spiritual guide in a way. And really looking at others, but with real tenderness, yes, looking at them directly, but not in an aggressive way, but with real tenderness and really taking them in, drinking them in, is the metaphor that Shantideva uses. And with a particular attitude, through them, Buddhahood is possible. Through them, Buddhahood is possible, because love and compassion are intrinsic to Buddhahood, to enlightenment. So that means that other people give us the opportunity to develop that without others, whatever they're like, however they are, enlightenment is impossible. And mindfulness of others involves action. You know, there are verses here where it's clear that the Bodhisattva is someone who takes initiative, being the first to act, to help, to improve, to bring benefit to others. So it's a very beautiful picture, I think, of the Bodhisattva. And, you know, I think if we study these verses, reflect on them, maybe we could see if we can try and practice them in some way. And these are just some of the ways in which we can practice mindfulness and metta conjoined, so to speak. Obviously, if we practice like this, we will also have to work on other aspects of mindfulness. We'll notice, if we really endeavour to do this, we'll notice negative states arising, unskillful states arising. And we will notice what needs to be curbed, what needs to be held in check, because they're just, you know, what actions and behaviour actually disrupt the flow of mindfulness, of metta for others. And if we practice like this, we'll find integration, absorption and concentration taking place. And negative emotions we need to reflect on: hatred, craving, indifference, anger, attachment, jealousy, conceit, all that lot. Anger, they're strongly disintegrating. They break us up. You know, maybe in a moment when they sort of take us over, we can feel sort of strangely concentrated. But the overall effect on consciousness of these states is strongly disintegrating. They divide us. They break us up. And they certainly divide us from our goal, from the purpose of our life, from going for refuge. So practicing metta will integrate us, will draw us together, draw our energies together into a unified flow. Sometimes people wonder, how can the metta bhavana lead to integration and absorption? Sometimes people wonder, because in the metta bhavana you are concentrating on others, and because you are to begin with, using you know, different mental activity to inculcate metta, surely that goes against concentration, which is a sort of simplification of consciousness. You know, this is there's a misunderstanding here. People do wonder if you can attain samadhi through metta, and you can. And traditionally, this is made very clear. In fact, in traditional explanations of the metta bhavana, it's said at different stages in the metta, you need to enter samadhi. You need to enter absorption. You need to become concentrated. The first time this is mentioned, this is in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, he says that there's an additional stage to the metta bhavana that you do after, before you move on to the good friend. He recommends that after meditating on metta in the first stage towards yourself, you bring to mind your Kalyana Mitra or your preceptor, or somebody like that. Clearly, you know, this reflects in that tradition the very positive feelings that people would have towards their preceptor or Kalyana Mitra. We can't teach it like this at beginners classes, of course, because people don't have that in their lives. But he says what you must do, if you think of that teacher, that spiritual friend, who you are in very positive relationship with, naturally, positive feelings will arise. Respect, reverence, love, goodwill, metta. And you can just then absorb yourself in that emotion. That's the word he uses. He actually says you enter samadhi. Doesn't sort of say what sort of samadhi. That's not the point. He's just making the point that you need to absorb yourself in that very, very positive well-wishing for that preceptor. He says then it's easy to develop metta in the other stages. In our own tradition, the second stage is a good friend who might be a Kalyana Mitra, but we say a good friend, you know, who we've got a straightforward feeling of friendliness towards. The point of this stage is that it's easy to develop clean, clear friendliness, love and well-wishing, and you allow yourself to be absorbed in that. It's really important to sort of sink into it. Maybe even as you come to the end of that stage of the practice, you sort of let go of even thinking about them or about anything, as it were. You just become absorbed very deeply in that friendliness. You allow all of your energy to flow into that. You sort of rest in it. And then you expand outwards to other, more, shall we say, difficult people. So the point that I'm making here is find the person who you easily have friendliness for and absorb yourself in that as much as possible and radiate out to others from that basis and keep returning to that absorption. Dip back into it regularly. This is what's recommended. Don't sort of just strain over difficult people, you know, I'm just ending up doing the Dvesha Bhavana, the hatred Bhavana. That isn't going to do you any good. That's you need to keep returning to the easy loving kindness and making sort of forays out to the difficult people. And over time, you'll notice that there is a sort of transfer of the loving kindness to those difficult people. Samadhi is also emphasised at the beginning of the fifth stage, that stage called equalising. It's very strongly emphasised, this stage. You know, it's recommended we spend a long time in this stage of the practice. It's called breaking down the barriers of preference, the preference for friend over enemy, self over enemy, the preference of friend over neutral person, self over neutral person, and so on. And it's recommended you spend time on this until you have entered samadhi. So you really keep going through those four people. in your mind. You know, there's all sorts of ways that this is recommended. Until such time as you feel, you can reach a sort of point where you're confident that you would feel, as it were, comfortable in loving kindness, whoever you were with. And it's said that at that point you should become absorbed in this equal loving kindness, this sameness of loving kindness. And this is important because it implies that our preferences lead to disintegration. Our preferences disintegrate us. The same strength of love, the same quality of loving kindness will be strongly absorbing and integrating. In fact, meditating deeply here, you not only dissolve preferences, you dissolve, at least for a little while, ideas of self and other. Shantideva describes in his chapter on Dhyana Paramita how to reflect, how to imagine sameness of self and other. His way of explaining it is as a sort of reflection, but we might not do it like this. We might do it in a more sort of intuitive, imaginative sort of way, but it does give us a picture of what we need to do. This is what's known as Paratma Samatha, the sameness of self and other, and it's a very, in a way, a very simple meditation in a sense, but very profound. At first, one should meditate intensely on the sameness of oneself and others, reflecting like this: all equally experience suffering and happiness, so I should look after others as I look after myself. Just as the body, which is made up of many parts, like the hands and other limbs, must be cared for as a single entity, so too should this entire world, though it is divided, is actually undivided in its nature to suffer and be happy. Even though my suffering does not cause distress in the bodies of others, I should nevertheless find their suffering intolerable because of the strong affection I have for myself. In the same way that, though I cannot experience another's suffering in myself, his suffering is hard for him to bear because of his strong affection for himself. I should destroy the suffering of others because it is suffering like my own suffering. I should help others too because they are beings just like myself. When happiness is loved by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive only for my own happiness? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not others? So the message here is this: we know how important we are to ourselves. We are incredibly important to ourselves. We want to avoid suffering. We want to be happy. We want to live without fear. We want to live in safety and security. We want the best for ourselves. Of course we do. All the things, the basic things that we want, we need to identify them. Others, all others, are exactly the same. Whether we like them, dislike them, whether we don't have any particular feeling for them, in that respect, they are exactly the same as ourselves. They want to avoid suffering. They want to be happy. They want to be protected. They want to feel secure. We don't need to have any information about them to know that they want to be happy. They want to be well. They want to avoid suffering. They want to avoid pain and fear. We know that because we are like that. We are the same as them. So we cherish them as we would cherish ourselves, whoever they are. We cherish them as we would cherish ourselves. They are the same. So we really need to imagine this, I think, when we go through the whole practice. You can even introduce this as a sort of practice in all of the stages. I think in the first stage, I mean, what I do sometimes is just reflect on being alive, getting a vivid sense of my life, of of breathing and being aware and how important that is to me. I mean, it doesn't matter what sort of mood I'm in, whether I sort of like myself or not. The fact is, I am living. And actually, that's quite important to me. In fact, it's very important to me. And I can sort of feel my sensitivity and all the rest of it. And I can reflect, well, actually, I want to be treated well and so on. Well, in the other stages, you reflect, well, they are exactly the same. If I'm like that, they are like that. So in the stages, what we do, and perhaps this especially comes in the third and fourth stage, it's sort of in the second stage, in a way you can sort of let rip with a friend. You just love them, and you can get into that. But perhaps with those other stages, you can reflect in that way. Well, in the same way, my life is very vivid to me. It's very vivid to them. It's very vivid to that neutral person, to that enemy. They feel it as much as I do. And they want to be happy. They want to be well. They want to avoid suffering. They might be going about it in a way that I think is completely weird. That's all irrelevant. In the basics, that's what they want. There is nothing special about me, says Shantideva. We are the same as everybody else. So we cherish them. We have metta for them. So, as I say, we can bring this reflection into all the stages. So that when we get to that, the beginning of the fifth stage, that sense of the equality of metta, the sameness of metta, is strong and vivid. And in that fifth stage, we become absorbed in that sameness of loving kindness, which is the basis for true loving kindness, which is the basis of loving kindness radiating everywhere. Interesting little note about equanimity. Very interesting. Look at whenever Bhante's been asked about equanimity, all he talks about is the sameness of loving kindness for everybody. He doesn't go into all the reflections on the classic reflections, which sometimes go with the equanimity bhavana, where you're developing metta while reflecting that beings are the inheritors of their deeds. He doesn't go into that, as far as I can tell. He emphasizes the sameness, and he said that will lead to a very, very deep peace. When you dissolve those distinctions, you enter that deep shanti, that deep upeksha. So when we look at metta in this way, we can see how metta can lead to insight, to wisdom. We're sort of moving in that direction. By the way, if you want to read up more about metta and insight, read Living with Kindness, where I think Bhante shows how every stage can be a sort of insight practice. Probably the language of insight isn't quite good enough, because it's using the metaphor of sight. The metaphor of sight does communicate something direct, at least, but it leaves out the element of transformation, of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha says that metta leads to the renouncing of all views, of all ditti, all positions. The Buddha here isn't just talking about wrong view or points of view. I think he's talking about all notions of self-reference. Self and other are left behind. And again, Shantideva has a reflection on this in his Dhyana Paramita chapter in the Bodhicharya Avatara. Not only does he write there about the sameness of self and others, but he also talks about the Paratma Parivartana, or the magical exchange of self and other. He says this: through force of habit, the idea of an I has attached itself to the seed and blood of other people, even though there is in fact no such thing as an I. So why don't I accept another's body as myself? That my own body is not my own is easy to see. I will renounce identifying with myself, and will take as myself other people.
one loves one's hands and limbs as members of the body. So why not love other living beings as members of the universe? By force of habit, one has come to imagine this body which has no self as a self. So why not practice to see oneself as residing in others? Through acting like this for the good of others, there is neither intoxication nor dismay. Even after giving oneself as food to others, there arises no expectation of reward. Therefore, in the same way that one desires to protect oneself from affliction, grief, and the like, so an attitude of protectiveness and of compassion should be practiced towards the world. Those who have developed their stream of consciousness in this way, who delight in pacifying the sufferings of others, plunge down into the deepest hell as geese into a cluster of lotus blossoms. Therefore, without any sense of loss, I offer my body as a servant to benefit the world. Though it has many faults, I carry it as a tool for that task. People can be fascinated by an Atman, by not self. They can be fascinated by shunyata, by emptiness. But this is its real practical application. Shantideva is saying, if there is no self, then it's easy to imaginatively identify with others. So go out of yourself in metta and sense and feel what it is to be another. In other verses in this section, in Shantideva's discussion of the exchange of others, he chooses very, very difficult people to identify with. Bhante has said that metta has an ecstatic quality. Ecstasy literally means standing outside of oneself. We achieve this through positively concentrating our attention on others, and that leads to a kind of self-forgetting. But it's important when you do this to have a strong sense of the beauty of all others. Beauty has a very important place in the Metta Bhavana, something Bhante strongly emphasises in his own discussions of metta, is aesthetic appreciation, looking for that aesthetic quality in others, the beauty in others. Bhante has quoted more than once the poet Shelley on love as a going out of ourselves and to see and sense the beauty in others. This is rather like this, or this can relate to the Buddha's Anukampa, his trembling with, his shaking with all beings. When he saw all beings as being like lotuses, he has a vision of their beauty, of their purity, of their spiritual potential, and he shakes with that, he quakes with that, he trembles with that. That's the real meaning of the Buddha's compassion. It's not a feeling of pity or a sorrow in a way at other people's suffering. It's a shaking with them, his direct vision of their Buddha potential. He shakes with that. He's seeing their purity, their beauty, and their nobility pushing up out of the slime, and he trembles with that. Bhante also says that talks about metta as aesthetic appreciation as the key to the realization of shunyata, of wisdom. He says that wisdom has an aesthetic quality. He picks up on Herbert Gunter's discussion of prajna as analytical, appreciative discrimination. And Bhante particularly picks up on that word, appreciative. What we're doing in the Metta Bhavana, and what wisdom is doing, is seeing others, all others, as they are in themselves, free from utilitarian concerns. You don't see them in terms of how you can use them in any way, in gross or subtle ways. You see them stripped of all attempts to fix them, to define them, to pigeonhole them. You see them aesthetically. In the end, Metta Bhavana culminates in states, if you can really call them states, which don't have any reference at all. Metta is known as a boundless state. There's no centre to it, no edge to it, no self, no other. And the Buddha has also said that metta, dwelling in the metta Brahma Vihara, leads to a formless liberation called the beautiful. seems to be quite a mysterious state, because it's not really discussed that much, as far as I know, in the Pali tradition. But you see all of existence as the beautiful that arises out of your metta practice. And Bhante was once asked, when being asked a question about why we practice metta before we do our visualization practice, referred to this. He said, all-pervading metta leads to an experience of formless beauty. And that was crucial, that experience of formless beauty, for an encounter with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. He described the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as sort of crystallizations of that formless beauty. That formless beauty, perhaps, of the bodhicitta. So you can see from this that metta is a key to the imagination. Bhante has also said this about metta, at the end of metta, if you like, in commenting on Dada Rinpoche's saying, radiate love. He says this, he starts by talking about friendship. Friendship is deep, one could say, to the extent to which it incorporates the transcendental, or rather to the extent that it is incorporated in the transcendental. It is deep to the extent that it is altruistic. It is deep to the extent that it is egoless. Deep friendship can be thought of as mutual awareness leading to mutual self-transcendence. Thus, true friendship, one could say, is the efflorescence of egolessness. In other words, we can radiate love only to the extent that we live united. To radiate means, according to the dictionary, to emit from a centre. The centre is the middle point, and a point is defined as that which has position without magnitude. The choice of this word is therefore very meaningful. We can radiate love only from the middle point of our being, from egolessness, from shunyata, from that point within ourselves which has position without magnitude. So it's clear from this that friendship and metta lead to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, and are indeed the expression of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Bhante regarded Dada Rinpoche as a living bodhisattva. He really did practice and live like those verses which I quoted, that came to the end of that last quote. Therefore, in the same way that one desires to protect oneself from affliction, grief and the like, so an attitude of protectiveness and of compassion should be practiced towards the world. Dada Rinpoche did that. Those who have developed their stream of consciousness in this way, who delight in pacifying the sufferings of others, plunge down into the deepest hell as geese into a cluster of lotus blossoms. Therefore, without any sense of loss, I offer my body as a servant to benefit the world. Though it has many faults, I carry it as a tool for that task. So Dada Rinpoche really lived like that. What this means is that we can do what needs to be done. This is a very interesting phrase, doing what needs to be done. It's actually not easy to do what needs to be done. It's not easy because we have so many things in the way of what needs to be done. We have so many kleshas, we have so much self-interest, so much egotism, which is in the way of what actually needs to be done. The direct response to the needs of others. So in the metta bhavana, moving towards this selfless metta, we reach a point where we can spontaneously do whatever needs to be done. That's not easy. So tomorrow we'll be looking at the bodhisattva ethics, especially in relation to the spiritual community and to the intensity of spiritual community.